Hi there, welcome to the Tom Raftery IT interviews. Today's illustrious guest on the Tom Raftery IT interviews is Michael Arrington of TechCrunch. First off, Michael, thanks for agreeing to do this interview.
Sure, Tom.
Michael, for anyone who's not familiar with your name, could you start off by telling the listeners who is Michael Arrington and what is it that you do?
I'll give you the short version. I grew up in California. Also spent about 3 years in near London with my parents when I was younger.
Right.
Went to college in California, law school here as well. Worked for a law firm in Silicon Valley called Wilson Sonsini, which is really was the first technology law firm ever, and is still by far the largest. And took Apple public in 1980, and sort of went from there.
Wow.
I got a lot of experience working with entrepreneurs, startups, and even big technology companies. I had my clients ranged from very young startups trying to raise venture capital, many of which, you know, were ultimately unsuccessful, to one of our clients was Steve Jobs, both Pixar and Next, and we sold Next to Apple and represented him in that. So just a very wide spectrum of clients and transactions, and it was a great way for me to get to know Silicon Valley and technology and just what it was all about. And also, I started at just the right time. I started practicing in 1995, and Netscape was one of our public and worked on all of their acquisitions, and so just really got a feel for what was going on. And had never been through any of the technology downturns, so I had nothing but a sense of optimism through the 90s. I did, though, near the end of the 90s. Got a little burnt out. We were at the law firm. We were working as a young associate. We were working an awful lot of hours, and I mean, just sort of night and day. I think I billed 2,700 hours my last year there, which means I was working all the time.
Wow.
And I was watching all of my clients, one, get rich, but two, just they were having such a great time doing it, and just, you know, just sort of the Wild West atmosphere. And so I decided, like a lot of attorneys at Wilson Sonsini have done over the years, to leave and join one of my clients. So I joined one of my, what I consider to be the hottest startup, a company that had already raised about $60 million in capital, and worked for them for a while, helped them on the sales and loss side. They filed to go public, and actually the market crashed, and they had sort of a sad story, which I won't go into, but
sure.
Before the company had crashed, I had left because I had the opportunity to actually start my own company. I wanted to be a founder. Started my own company with some executives out of Visa called HX. We raised money from Draper Fisher Jurvetson and some other funds, and it was a great ride. We sold the company 13 months, I think, after we incorporated it. And that was after the bubble had burst, and so it was a lot of fun. And actually that company is now the back end for Western Union Online. So the technology lives on, which I'm quite proud of. So I sort of have a grounding in corporate law.
Sure.
And obviously I've been and continue to be an entrepreneur. I'm doing some things now as well. One of the things I did while I was at the law firm was I wrote a book with another attorney on initial public offerings. And it's hard. It took a lot of time, but it was a lot of fun and very rewarding. And I think I just sort of fell in love with writing then. And so when blogging started to take off, I was sort of naturally drawn to it.
Right.
And as a personal blog, I had my own blog that just my family and friends read. But this year I obviously decided to get a little bit more serious about it and started TechCrunch.
Right. And how long has TechCrunch been running now?
Started on June 11th this year. So it'll be 6 months, December 11th. So
brilliant.
It's still a young blog.
I was interviewing Robert Scoble on this podcast last week, and he said he'd never heard of TechCrunch 6 months ago, which is obviously understandable. And he said now it's the first site he looks at every day.
He's told me that Memorandum is the first site he looks at every day.
He's contradicting himself.
That's a great compliment. He's actually helped me out a lot with my blogging, both as an inspiration and sort of helping me with writing style, because blogging is very different than any other kind of writing.
Yeah.
But also just because, you know, he links to me quite often, and that obviously helps with traffic.
Sure, sure. To get to the point where someone like Robert points at you often, where he looks at you every day, where FeedBurner is reporting you have 15,000 subscribers now, how do you attribute the success of, to what do you attribute that success in 6 months?
There's a few things. I'm actually pretty humble about it because I think I randomly decided to write about the right thing at the right time. The blogger that's helped me out a lot as well, named Richard McManus, who has a very large blog called Read Write Web, and he writes some amazing stuff on his blog. And I got to know him right at the beginning of blogging. Actually, I think he pinged me when he saw my blog come online.
Right.
And he worked for, you know, I think 2 or 3 years before this year on his blog, and had very little growth. And this year it just exploded. And I think his writing has been consistently good. I think what changed is an interest level in entrepreneurialism, venture capital, and other things on the web. A lot of that, I think, was because of the Google IPO last year, and then the Flickr acquisition also, just sort of people realized that liquidity events were possible again, mostly through acquisition, but possibly through IPO. And so when I started the blog, I just started at the perfect time, and I was writing about things that obviously was of interest to people as new companies. And I think a lot of people are just generally interested in reading about new companies. I think a lot of entrepreneurs want to see what else is out there to, you know, try to get some market intelligence. I found a lot of VCs are interested in getting an early look at companies they may not see otherwise quite so soon. So it appeals to a large audience of people who are interested in technology.
Yeah.
And I try to write in a very authentic and sort of transparent way, and try to keep things sort of informal. I try to write honestly, and when I don't know about technologies, I admit as much. And I've also learned quite a bit along the way. So I think it's a mixture of all those things. I think some bloggers have trouble, even when they write good stuff, just getting seen. And I don't think now is a good time to go into advice on how those bloggers can do a better job. I'm happy to talk to you about it. But I think that another thing that's really helped me is just knowing people like Robert Scoble and Dave Weiner, who've linked to me. I met Dave earlier this year, and he hired me and Keith Teer, my business partner, to help him sell Weblogs Inc. I'm sorry, Weblogs.com. And we were successful in selling it to VeriSign, but I became friends with him in the process of doing that.
Excellent.
And he's helped me out with the blog quite a bit as well.
Right. Now, since TechCrunch is such a success, it must keep you incredibly busy. Is it a full-time job? Or, I mean, you alluded to helping Dave with the sale of the site there as well. So it's obviously not completely a full-time job, but it must be nearly 90% of your time?
I don't call it a job, I call it a hobby.
And
it's
nice.
Turned into a bit of an obsession, I'll admit that. But it's very rewarding. I mean, you see people comment, you see new readers come. And even when they flame you, you at least know that they're reading. And and blogging can be a very rewarding process that way, by getting feedback. And so I do spend quite a bit of time on it. I would say, you know, I'll spend anywhere from an hour to 10 hours a day on it. But my day job is actually working on my own startup called Edgio, which will be launching sometime soon. And we have a 6-person startup that's just raising funding now, and that certainly is what takes up the bulk of my time every day.
Sorry, what did you say the name was?
It's called Edgio. It's the word edge and then IO.
Right.
So it's edgio.com. And I think we have a landing page up now where people can put in their email addresses. But it's a Web 2.0 company, and we, you know, there's another reason why I started TechCrunch was just I knew early this year we were going to launch a company, and we had 3 or 4 ideas that Keith Teer and I, my partner, were kicking around. And I think getting to know what other companies are doing can help an entrepreneur refine their own product, and specifically which features to include and which not to include, what works and what doesn't. And so TechCrunch has been for me a tremendous due diligence project, where I've sort of gone out and seen everything, or almost everything out there on the web. New things are launching so fast now I can't keep up with them, but I would say even of the stuff I write about, that's only 10% of what I look at. So I'm looking at a tremendous number of new products, and that's helped us, I think, refine the feature set for Edgio.
Brilliant. You don't have ads on the site. How do you fund it? Is it through your full-time day job, or?
Yeah, the costs have been minimal so far. Hosting is still hosted on a shared server, and that needs to change because the site's actually been going down quite a bit recently from too much traffic. But, you know, shared hosting is cheap. I think it's $20 a month. I did a site redesign from a guy named Fred Oliveira in Portugal midsummer and paid him for that. And I think the site design was terrifically successful in helping the content really break out from the blog and let me drew many more readers. But other than that, the expenses have only been the opportunity cost of my time. And as I said, it's a hobby. I don't consider it a job. And, you know, with any hobby, I think people can be very obsessive about things and passionate. So up until now, costs have been low. I need to go out and get a dedicated server. That's going to cost something. But and what I really need is to hire a staff of one or two people to help with research and writing. And obviously there'll be an expense associated with that. And I am thinking about, I am adding advertising to help defray those costs. I've joined John Battelle's FM publishing group to test that out and see how that works. But quite frankly, I mean, advertising on blogs is not a very effective way to make a lot of money. It might help
unless
you know,
you're
cover
Jason
the expenses
Calacanis.
Of one. Pardon me?
Unless you're Jason Calacanis.
Yeah, although, you know, even he, you know, was only making, I think he said $1 million a year, and he was running a pretty big operation with a lot of bloggers on being paid. But yeah, certainly you could scale things up and try to make more revenue that way.
Sure.
But TechCrunch will never be that. I mean, TechCrunch is an industry rag that, you know, certain people are interested in, but it'll never be even an Engadget or, you know, where, you know, just tens of thousands of people want to read everything that they write every day. So I don't know. I actually don't know what I'm going to do about that. I do need to get some full-time help on it.
Okay, you brought up John Battelle's Federated Media Publishing there, the fact that you've recently joined it. Can you explain what that is and how do you see that changing TechCrunch?
Yeah, so John started FM with the stated goal of helping bloggers get a paycheck so they can continue to spend most of their time, or at least as much of their time as they want, doing what they love, which is blogging. It's young. I haven't actually served an ad on my site yet. So it's still, the jury's still out on whether or not they'll be able to generate enough revenue to support sites. But I think they have a really good chance. And they have, you know, they have John's, the sites John is already affiliated with, his own blog and Boing Boing and Waxy, you know, right from the start. And so, you know, he's got a nice network effect kicked in right from the beginning. So it was actually attractive to me to join that network and even just to be affiliated with those blogs. Also, O'Malik has joined and others. So, you know, just from wanting to hang out with guys like that on the blogosphere, it's been a success already. We'll see how how much revenue flows in from it.
How is it different from, say, the Google AdWords?
I've never run AdWords on my own site. I have heard that some sites have done, you know, quite well with that, but I don't have any direct experience with it. So,
okay. Changing tack a little for a second. What's the story with the barbecues and how did that tradition get started?
So I was actually living in Manhattan Beach at the beginning of this year and started TechCrunch from there. And I was traveling up here quite a bit for Edgio, almost every week, and staying with Keith at his house. It was very nice of him to let me stay there with his family. And I realized probably in July or August that I had to move up here. And so And I think I've been here 3 months now. I live in Atherton.
Where is here, Michael?
It's Atherton, which is just north of Palo Alto, which is about 25 miles south of San Francisco.
Gotcha. Okay.
So it's the heart of Silicon Valley. I mean, it's you know, 10 minutes away from Xerox Park, and you know, 5 minutes away from Stanford University. And it's where a lot of stuff is going on. So I moved in, and almost the day I moved in, we brought one of our engineers for Edgio over from Europe to work here for a couple of months and stay in my house and work, and then the web 2.0 conference was coming up, and so other people were staying at my house for that. And we just decided we're going to have a barbecue. It was nothing more than that, but everyone invited a couple of people. And so a barbecue that I expected, you know, 5 people to be at, it turned into 25 or 30, and we had the founders of YouTube were over, and a couple of VCs dropped by, and it was a small but just great networking event and a lot of fun. And so I think a week later we decided to have a full-blown party with the wiki and all that, and 100 people showed up for that one. So it just sort of happened, and I really think that it's not that I throw great parties, it's that people, the Valley has grown a lot recently, and there's a lot of new people to the Valley again. There's a lot of people that have been in hibernation for a couple of years.
Sure.
And there's no real voice yet to sort of speak on their behalf and events for them to get together and things like that. Bar Camp and others have emerged as well to help with this. But at the time when I started, there just was nothing. I think people were really yearning for just a place to get together and hang out and talk about their companies and be a little bit less insecure about what they're doing, as all entrepreneurs are always somewhat insecure. So again, I think it was good timing, and now it's been a lot of fun. I had three of them, and then the fourth one was Rio's launch party. There's going to be another one in January or February. It'll be the launch party for a much anticipated book that's coming out that I can't say which one, but it's going to be a lot of fun. So.
Okay. TechCrunch is part of the Web 2.0 work group. Can you explain what the Web 2.0 work group is?
Yeah, so it's a small project with goals, but not lofty ones. It was started by Richard McManus, who I mentioned, and Fred Oliveira, who I mentioned as well, and I. And we just, one night, we were at my house, we were all working, and we just decided that we linked to each other quite a bit, and there really wasn't any reason why we shouldn't have a single site where we're all listed that we can point to, you know, maybe instead of or in addition to linking to each other on good posts. So we just basically put something up. I think it took 20 minutes for Fred to design it and put it up, and we all posted on it, and immediately we had other bloggers come in and ask to be a part of it, and so now it's up to 20. I posted today, it's up to 20 blogs, and it isn't exclusive in the sense of it's hard to get into. All that's really required is you write, you know, an intelligent, meaningful blog on, you know, what's going on the web today, and we've got, you know, some great blogs up there, and it's been a lot of fun. I think there are things we can do with it over time to increase functionality, but for right now, it's just a fun place for all of us to hang out and point to.
Brilliant. That brings us on to Web 2.0. What is Web 2.0? The great question. Is it just another catch-all buzzword like interactive, designed to grab the attention of VCs, or does it actually have a meaning?
Well, it has two meanings to me. So the first one is, we clearly went through a winter on the web where a lot of innovation was taking place, but not a lot of funding, and no liquidity events of any note were happening for a couple of years after 2001. And I said a lot of innovation was going on. I think it was. And a lot of it was going on, sort of these, you know, the new technologies that we're seeing today, and they all blossomed really starting in 2004 for the most part. And I think that it's easy to say, look, we had a winter, we had a clear break in innovation, or at least in liquidity events, and now we have it started again. So it's easy to say, look, we're on the next version of the web. And I think John Furrier, the PodTech guy, was the first one to say that in a comment on O'Malley's blog, that, you know, the easy way to define Web 2.0 is it's just the next version of Web 1.0. And I like that, and it sort of stuck with me. But clearly there are tools now that entrepreneurs can use that just weren't available a few years ago.
Yeah.
Ajax is one, although Ajax has been around for 10 years or 9 years now, the basic ideas around it. But things like Ruby on Rails and platforms to build Ajax applications very quickly and easily had not been around so long.
Mm-hmm.
And they are now, and you can build applications now in a matter of days or weeks that would take a year before, and maybe $10 million in capital, you can now do it with significantly less, next to nothing. I think Edgio, we certainly have spent less than $100,000 now, and we're getting ready for launch. So it's the ability to use these tools to create applications, I think, is very important. But also, I think some of the stuff Fred Wilson's written on the two-way web, it was very influential in my thinking about this as well. Going from GeoCities in Web 1.0 to blogging today, it's just it's clearly going from looking at fairly static content on a website to going to a highly interactive process where you have constant posts refreshing and you have people with the ability to leave comments and dropbacks and interact with the content, and a real discussion can take place. And I think that's, you know, just absolutely exploded to go beyond blogging to almost every aspect of applications that we see on the web. I mean, Flickr is another example, although I think Flickr is arguably blogging, but it's just, you know, obviously you can share your photos very easily, people can comment on them, save them as favorites and things like that. So it's that interactiveness that I think is important to what's going on the web today.
Right. Of the Web 2.0 apps that are out there at the moment, is there one, is there a couple, you know, is there a group of them that you couldn't live without? What would they be?
Sure. Flickr. I could not live without Flickr. I could not live without the blogging tools that are available today that let me write TechCrunch in such an easy way. Although a lot of those tools have been around for a while, but they're so much easier to use now. It's so much easier to self-publish on the web. You don't need to know any HTML at all today to do it. An example is my dad blogs, and everybody has an example of a friend who's a Luddite who can blog because they don't need to know any sort of technology. But Flickr blogging, I've fallen in love with things like Pandora, which is a music recommendation engine and streams music to your computer.
Yeah.
I would say that 90% of the time that I'm writing, I'm listening to Pandora. In fact, I had it on before you called. Things like Rhea are amazing. I don't know if you're familiar with Rhea, but the ability
I haven't tried it.
The ability to just upload your entire photo collection, thousands and thousands and gigs upon gigs of photos, and identify a person in those photos at most once. Sometimes it will automatically detect who they are, and then automatically tag that person in that photo each and every time they appear. It's such an amazing way to add metadata that absolutely can't live without it. And I could probably go on, but off the top of my head, those are the ones that I can think of.
Excellent. Ad-supported sites seem to be coming the norm these days. We were talking about it a little earlier. Do you think everything is going to be headed that way? Do you think, for instance, that someday we'll see an online version of Office or even Windows supported by ad revenue?
It's funny. I was at the Microsoft Live press event, and I thought that's what they were. I actually heard before, and they weren't going to announce it, but I was hoping they would. They would announce a full online version of Office, and someday that has to come. I was actually just a few minutes ago playing with NumSum, which is an online version of Excel, and it's a functional spreadsheet that uses Ajax technology and presents itself as a desktop application online. It's absolutely stunning.
Yeah,
I think those technologies are coming. Now, whether or not they can be ad-supported, I think, is a separate question. And I asked John Battelle this recently at an event because he gave us a talk, and he got into the Google effect and the fact that entire businesses can now be created that are supported just on the Google platform with AdWords. It couldn't exist before because they had no revenue opportunity.
Uh-huh.
And the question I asked him afterwards was, what happens when the advertising industry, as it typically does, goes through a cycle and goes through a downturn? Does that mean that Google will be hit, but also all of their partners that get revenue through Google will be hit? And I think the answer is yes, it'll hit, and it'll hit hard. His answer was no, for two reasons. He said, one, CPC advertising, or cost per click, is much harder for companies, even in a downturn, to turn off completely as opposed to discretionary marketing spending. The reason it's harder is because, he didn't say this, but the reason I think it's harder is it's just so easy to track your ROI through CPC spending, whereas you can't track ROI through a Super Bowl ad. And so I think that's one reason why it maybe won't hit Google as hard. But we'll just have to see.
All right. Speaking of Super Bowl ads, are you a Mac user or a PC user?
My first computer was an Apple II Plus. So I started off with Mac. But I made a critical decision in college to go with PC over Mac. And that was led by my father, who knew PCs at the time. So that decision was made. And honestly, the porting costs up until now have been too high, just too much invested in software, basically. But I think my next computer is going to be a Mac. You can do so much online now, and so much of the software I have bought is coming up to be, time to renew it or just stop using it. It very well could be a Mac. I'm a huge iPod fan, and I like a lot about what Apple's doing, so we'll see. I'll update you on that when I decide.
Excellent.
What are you, Tom? Are you on a Mac?
I'm on a Mac, yeah. I have been for a long time. I do a lot of server work for people, and that's all Windows 2000, Windows 2003. I do work for people in Exchange and things like that as well, a lot of server-based stuff. So I know PCs, I've worked PCs for a long, long time, but my own personal machine is and has been a Mac for years and years.
Now, I would have thought that Intel, given its presence in Ireland, would have spawned a significantly higher level of loyalty in an Irishman to have an Intel-based machine. So you must be, would that tear you at all? Are you happy that Mac's moving to Intel?
Well, yeah, I am. I don't have any problem with that. I think it's a good move. I have a very specific reason for wanting them to move to Intel, and that is that my own personal computer is a PowerBook G4.
Mm-hmm.
And of course there's no PowerBook G5.
Right.
Because they couldn't come up with a G5 to go into a PowerBook.
Right.
So I think that was a huge reason behind Apple's move to Intel, and for that reason I think it's a good thing.
Well, you should get what you want early next year, right?
So Hopefully. Yep. The other thing though, you're talking about Intel being based in Ireland, and it's true they are, but they're based in Dublin. I'm based in Cork, and that's mm-hmm. where Apple's plant is.
I didn't know that.
Okay. Yeah, Apple have a big plant here in Cork. So, in fact, my wife worked there for a while. So, yeah, no, I'm an Apple fan, have been for a long time.
I have just time for a quick aside, and feel free to edit this out later, but
sure.
I've been to Ireland a few times, and a very good friend who lives in London who's from Ireland, and the last time we were there, I wanted to go and kiss the Blarney Stone. And so we were in Galway, and we drove way out of our way down to Cork
sure.
To do that. And, I mean, it was like a whole day drive, and we got down there, and there was probably a 25-minute line to do it.
Oh, yeah.
And he'd done it before, being Irish, and he said, "We're absolutely not waiting in this line." And and Ian said, "We have to go. We have to get out of here because we have to get to Dublin tonight." So we ended up not doing it, and it's been a point of contention in our friendship ever since. So I made it to the actual point, but never did kiss it. So.
Did you hear? I got Robert Scoble to promise he's going to do it when he's here next week.
No, that's right. He's doing his Europe tour.
That's right. He's coming to a conference that I'm involved in the organization of next week.
Is it in Cork?
In Cork, yeah.
Great.
He's flying in here on the 28th. We'll be going. I'll be dragging him up to the Blarney Stone on the 29th, and the conference is on the 30th. So
that's great.
Yeah, we're going to get some pictures of that and get them up in Flickr.
Yeah, I'll point to those. That's great.
Finally, a really deep and serious question. What kind of world do you want your kids to grow up in?
I think a lot of the ways technology is headed are really exciting. I was listening on, I was doing a long drive yesterday, I was listening to a radio show talking about video games and how they're getting more violent, how that could be screwing up children's heads. And one of the callers said that, in his opinion, that... yeah, the violence isn't great, but video games are so complicated today that it's actually increasing the IQ levels of children who are playing them, and certainly hand-eye coordination is a proven fact. I think there's some good things about technology, and I almost am jealous for children today being able to grow up in a technology-immersive environment, from the start. But yeah, there's certainly things that worry me, and more on just the biotech front and things like that, and maybe it's because I don't understand those industries, but it seems like some of those, some of the technologies being developed can very easily be put to evil. But for the most part, I'm optimistic for the next generation and the generation after, and that they'll live in a cleaner, smarter, more interesting world than we do. So.
Yeah, I think so too. Thanks very much for your time, Michael. It's been fascinating.
Thank you, Tom. I really appreciate you bringing me on.
No problem. Hopefully we'll get you back here again sometime soon. In the meantime,
Anytime.
In the meantime, we'll sign off for now.